right, all right. Welcome to Recovery Uncensored. This is your host, Ty Beckel, with our very, very special guest, Mike Morrison. How you doing over there, Mike?
Good, Ty. Thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem. I'm really, really pleased to have you here. I feel like I've never met you in person, but I feel like I've know almost your whole life story from working with your wife. So when I was like trying to put the guest list together, like who could I get on the show that can kind of help me and help the audience who's listening kind of figure out is this a disease? Is this not a disease? So really, we got to look at it like doesn't matter. And that's what we want to kind of hope to look towards today after having you on and you being in the industry for so long. And as we were talking earlier before we started recording, you know, you're not a scientist, I'm not a scientist, but there's a lot of science around it. But I wanted to kind of give a background, if you're okay with it. I would love to give a background a little bit about you, because when you sent me your resume, I'm like, oh my gosh.
I'm on the back end of my career path, and you're on the front end of yours.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to kind of move a balance together. Right. And, guys and girls listening, he sent me this, and he's being very modest. He's got a very, very long career. Mike, how long do you got clean and sober?
It was 40 years last April.
Last April. That's a long. That's older. I'm not even that old, you know. So 41 years coming up this April. Yeah. As long as you keep doing what you're doing, you'll have 41 years in April. And when you sent me this resume, I looked at it. I'm like, man, 40 years? Okay. And then you said you started as a trainee in the Edgewood program. Right. That's right. Edgewood program. In May of 79. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit what you got clean and sober?
Yeah, it was really weird back then, okay? It wasn't like it is now, and I'm not saying it was right. Matter of fact, it probably wasn't. Okay, here's how I got into the field, okay?
Okay.
I mean, years of active addiction, ended up doing heroin, other opiates. Mm-hmm. Went into treatment, spent a month in treatment, and the day before I got out, the clinical supervisor of the program asked me to go outside and take a walk with him, and I said okay, and we went out, and he says, hey, you're getting out tomorrow, Mike, right? And I go, yeah. And he goes, what are you gonna do? And I said, I'm not sure, you know, I gotta get a job, and my parents are gonna let me come home and live with them. He said, you ever thought about getting into the field, the treatment business? And I said, well, no. And he goes, well, would you like to?
You're just getting ready to get out.
The day before.
He's recruiting you for a job.
And he's like, you know, we have a counselor training program here.
Okay.
And if you're interested, we think you might be a good candidate for it. Well, are you interested? And I'm like, sure. So the very next day, I showed up to the same treatment center with a tie on, reporting for a counselor training. You know, in the next 12 months, I spent in a training program, and that's kind of how it started. You know, so I spent basically 40 years in extended care.
Oh wow! So you get the next day, you get out of treatment, and you show up, and in 12 months, you spend training.
Yeah.
And then after those 12 months, were you like a counselor? Like, were you?
Well, you had to interview if they needed counselors. They happened to need a couple of counselors when I finished the training program. And you know, so I interviewed and I got a job, and you know, it was awesome for me. I mean, my whole career was built upon that. You know, there were I think 16 trainees in the group that I was in at various points of their training, and I think only about half actually finished. You know, I mean, some people just quit, but a number of people relapsed. So,
okay. So, man, that's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And your resume, you have, man, you worked at, let's see, you have here, you became the certified substance abuse counselor, eventually promoted to senior counselor, and then you moved to Mississippi, became director of a new 40-bed program for Mercy Health, and then you go into the director of operations. So, I don't know. You kind of mentioned, you said, you know, I don't think it was right, but I mean, for you.
For me, it was right.
For you, it's like, hey, they gave you a shot. You're like, hey, you're clean, wet behind the ears. Let's just go ahead and jump right in.
Yeah, and, you know, I really, you know, my education was one of the things that was most affected by my using. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I started out life with, you know, a lot of advantages and a lot of potential and did well in school and was a Boy Scout and a Cub Scout and my parents took me to Sunday school and I played Cory League baseball. I was on a trajectory, you know, that my parents wanted me to do great things. You
right.
know? And then when I was, I guess, 14, I started smoking weed,
mm-hmm.
and I can literally put that day on a calendar and see that everything started to unravel right from that point on. And by the time I got out of school, you know, I couldn't go to a college. I had to go to junior college in order to even get into a regular college, and I had screwed school up so bad, you know. So all I really knew was getting high and partying, right. and I didn't have any job skills. So it was like, are you kidding me? This is, I can use my past to benefit other people.
Yeah. You
know? So it was a great opportunity.
And I've heard good things about you, not just from your wife. I was actually, you probably didn't see me, but this was maybe 2 years ago. You were at a town hall meeting out at the hospital. It was actually held at the hospital.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Steve Nahn, Madison County Coroner, was there, right. and I was there on behalf of Amari, the mm-hmm. non-for-profit that I'm the executive director of. And you were very intriguing, just the way you spoke and the how long that you've been in this industry. Because I believe you were, if I remember correctly from your resume, you became the CEO of Bridgeway mm-hmm. Healthcare. Is that right?
Bridgeway Behavioral.
Behavioral Health.
Yeah.
Okay, and are you retired now? Like,
yeah.
What do you got going?
Well, we merged with another company 4 years ago now, and I had a 3-year employment contract after that merger, and my employment contract ran out, and I'm on a non-compete now. That was part of my contract, so I'm just like kicking back doing other stuff for a while, and I've gotten out of the field.
Speaking of doing other stuff, I actually, your wife had some of your art. So those of you listening right now, I work with Mike's wife at a local hospital, and she's got her office full of his art. And by what I understand, you have a studio at your house, an art studio, and you dabble in paint, mm-hmm. sculpting, mm-hmm. Pottery.
Yeah.
And I was so intrigued by this. I asked his wife, I'm like, what is this thing? It's like I have it here, and I know you guys can't see it. I'm going to explain it the best that I can. I'm like, it made me think of like a goblet from like the medieval times. And if you see it, it stands probably about 5-6 inches tall. It's kind of got a glaze. It's kind of got a little bit of brown, a little bit of a light brown. And I'm leading up to it because on the side, it's got little faces. And the face, when I first saw this, if you've ever seen the movie Return to Oz, they have the Wheelers in there in the face, because the Wheelers terrified me when I was a kid. When I saw this movie, and I saw this, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that reminds me of the Wheelers. So I'm going to take a picture of this, and we're going to upload this eventually online, whether it's social media, just so you guys can see what I'm talking about. But can you explain the faces, since this is one of the things that you do? Like, what was going on when you did this?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm not like a trained artist, you know. I do outside art and whatever mm-hmm. comes to my mind. And I had got these little molds of faces from somewhere. And I got on this kick where I would just take clay and mold these little faces. And what I did with them, that was the only thing I did from a pottery standpoint, is I fired them, and then I went all around and I took super glue and glued them onto buildings all around St. Louis. Yeah, and just to, I don't know why. I mean, it was somehow related to like graffiti or something.
Yeah.
I just think in my
so
mind.
So you put little bitty faces all over the place.
I just thought it would be funny to have people like be walking into a store and look over and see this little teeny face glued on. Yeah.
Have you been by spots that you put and see if they're still there?
Not there anymore.
Not there? People are like, no, we can't have this.
Right.
Yeah, because like, I wanted to name it, and I don't know if you've named it, but I wanted like the Goblet of Souls, because it's like it you know, the medieval feel and mm-hmm. kind of like a spiritual sense that you captured some souls and they were cursed to damnation to this goblet. So, yeah, I wanted to bring that in and yes, it sits in our office. I definitely admire it and I can't thank you enough. I know this was kind of short notice and stuff, but so I really, really appreciate it. And your resume is great. You've been in the industry for so long. And I know you're active in the recovery community. And one thing that I wanted to talk about before we really move on to the topic that we're going to cover today is you helped correct terminology? You helped found Kappa.
Right.
If you want to explain a little bit of what Kappa is.
Yeah. So about 8-9 years ago, I got a call from a professor at WashU named David Patterson. Okay, he works at the Brown School. Cool. And he asked me if he could come to Bridgeway and do some research with our staff about barriers to people in the field accepting evidence-based practices. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I said, absolutely. I said, that would be awesome. Come on in. And so he came in. He and some of his staff interviewed all of our staff. And he came back a month later or something. He presented these findings, you know, which really showed that about a third of the staff were really interested in evidence-based, you know, science-based practices. A third would do them if they were asked to. And a small percentage of people said that they wouldn't do it even if their boss told them to.
Okay.
That they were set in their ways. They knew what they were doing. They had been doing it for years, and they were just, you know, pretty much intractable. And I found that really interesting. But over the years, I as the CEO, I was pushed so many times to use different evidence-based practices.
Mm-hmm.
By outside influences, okay, by credentialing bodies, by drug courts, by, you know, people, and oftentimes it was somebody went to a conference, they heard a cool speaker with some new booklet they had for the jail population or for women or whatever, and they would come back and say, I want you to use this now. It's evidence-based.
Okay.
And you'd have to, like, you know, change everything and start doing it. And it was really hard to know what really worked, you know,
right.
What really works to help people move forward in to recovery. And I told him this professor, I said, you know, I said, do you know, can you like really outline what does science show works best to help people in treatment and recovery? And he goes, I can some. And from that conversation, we kind of became friends,
mm-hmm.
and decided that the field probably needed some organization that would really look at what science says.
Right.
Not, you know, because for so many years we've been really practicing based upon anecdotal type of, you know, evidence about what works. Personal experiences that worked for me, so it's mm-hmm. going to work for you. And that, you know, that kind of stuff has gone on for years and years and years and years. And the truth is there's some science that shows that there are certain things that work better than others. And
right.
So we wanted to look into what are those things and then disseminate that information to the field. And so it's the Community Academic Partnership on Addiction. It's still going. And
that's cool.
Yeah, so that's kind of how it started.
That's really cool. And speaking of science, you know, we are going to kind of talk a little bit about this first episode. We wanted to cover addiction as a disease because for whatever reason, it always seems like it's a hot topic. It's like when you kind of throw it out there that addiction is a disease, everybody all of a sudden becomes someone that's had a PhD, you know, and same thing with politics.
Yeah,
everybody
right.
seems to become a political pundit and
right.
knows everything. And I even get caught up in that sometimes, and I try to do my best not to do that because there's a scientist doctor who was like an atheist, but he became a believer of God, Dr. Francis Collins, I believe.
Yeah.
He's got a really interesting book, but when I saw one of his, he was in an interview and he was talking about knowledge in the universe. He said, if we were to take all this knowledge and put it on this table in front of us right now, collectively, everybody in the universe, we would still only know a speck of knowledge, speck of dust. And that kind of resonated with me because, you know, my personal story, you know, before I got clean and sober, I always felt this need that I had to be the smartest guy in the room, or if I looked stupid, if I said something wrong, I'd get really embarrassed, because ultimately, at the end of the day, I really struggled with self-esteem really badly. And I always tell people, like, if I seemed like I was very cocky, it was just me trying to be confident, and I didn't know how to be confident.
Right.
And today I get to look at that, and when I look at the perspectives of some of the science stuff, because I am I'm kind of putting this out there, I'm a nerd for the human brain. I'm not an expert by any means, but I love learning stuff about the brain. I love like interpersonal neurobiology. I think it's a really interesting field.
Yeah.
And what they've been able to discover from the brain over the past 10, 15 years has really allowed us to examine so many things, even outside the scope of addiction, from the way we interact with one another, from the mirror neurons and all that stuff. So yes, episode one, we're going to kind of tackle it, and we kind of laughed and joked about it. We're going to help come to a conclusion. I know I have a really good idea what our conclusion will be, but we just want to kind of have a really organic conversation about it. We have a few clips and stuff that we're going to kind of go over. I actually have one clip, and then I have one spot in this book that I want to pull out and just read. But so yes, episode one, our official title is Disease or Not a Disease? That is the question, you know, kind of pulling from the Shakespearean influence there. But because we're going to talk about a few things, and neither one of us are experts, but we have a little bit of knowledge, and we hope the listeners will follow along. And, you know, hopefully the idea is to even engage in social media or a website of discussion about this. So, but before we get into that, we wanted to take a quick break, if that's all right with you, so we can hear from Gateway Foundation, one of our sponsors. And so we'll take a quick minute, and we will be back.
It's time to get serious about your drug or alcohol problem. It's going to cost you your job, your marriage, your family, and possibly your life. But there is a proven answer. For 50 years, the Gateway Foundation has helped over 1 million people just like you turn their lives around and free themselves from addiction. We can tailor an individualized treatment program to meet your needs and situation, from outpatient to residential options, at one of our 13 in-state locations. You can get the help you need to get your life back under control. And if you have private insurance, treatment may be of little or no cost to you. But we can't help you if you don't call us. Please, one of our counselors is ready to have a confidential conversation with you right now at 1-877-629-4829. That's 1-877-629-4829. Call 1-877-629-4829 before it's too late.
All right, welcome back. Again, thank you to Gateway Foundation for being one of our sponsors. So we're going to kind of get into the meat and potatoes of what we're going to kind of talk about today. And again, it is addiction. Is it a disease or is it not a disease? And I really think, Mike, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think a good place to start is, what the hell is the definition of a disease anyways?
Yeah.
You know, before we kind of jump into that, or anybody jumps into that, do you, listening, do you understand what an actual disease is and what's the definition? Because from my understanding, the definition of disease has changed over the years. Are you okay with me reading from Britannica.com, what they kind of lay out?
Sure,
yeah, so those listening and following along, Britannica.com, they have a definition of a disease that I kind of liked. Let me just let it load here and... there we go. It says here, a disease, any harmful deviation from the normal structural or functional state of an organism, generally associated with certain signs and symptoms and differing in nature from physical injury. A diseased organism commonly exhibits signs or symptoms indicative of its abnormal state. Thus, the normal condition of an organism must be understood in order to recognize the hallmarks of disease. Nevertheless, a sharp demarcation between disease and health is not always apparent. So to some, that's like, okay, well, what does that mean? And I love the really part there where it says, to understand disease in an organism, you have to understand the normal state. Mm. And we, you know, you've probably heard this before, normal is usually just a setting on a washing machine.
Right.
But really to kind of break that down, what does that, for you, when we think about the definition of disease, what do you think that means from your perspective?
Well, I mean, this is a question we all ask ourselves, I think, you know, and I was told a long time ago something very similar to that, that a disease is something that, you know, causes harm to an organism, that has an etiology or a cause, either known or unknown, because
mm-hmm.
certainly we don't know the cause of all diseases in the world, no matter what kind of disease. It runs an identifiable course. It has a set of signs and symptoms, and it has certain outcomes that are fairly predictable. Okay, and you know, when I thought about that and applied it to addiction, well, we're not 100% sure where addiction comes from. We know mm-hmm. a lot about it, but we don't. You know, there are people that seem to have different beginnings to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem to run a certain course, and there are signs and symptoms that we can all recognize. If you know just even a little bit about addiction or alcoholism, you can kind of recognize it. And it has outcomes that are pretty predictable for the most part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so using that kind of general definition of a disease, I certainly thought, well, okay, this fits. You know, now when I was in treatment, I remember like carrying it to ridiculous places, though. Like, I remember standing in a lecture hall where this guy saying, you know, like, it's no different than heart disease. It's just no different than heart disease. And people sitting there nodding their heads going, oh, uh-huh, that's right. It's like heart disease. And then looking at each other going, like, what the hell is this guy talking about? It's like heart
yeah.
disease. I like to get messed up, you know, too much. It's not like heart disease.
Right.
And it never made sense, really, to me, even though I knew there was something wrong with me.
Okay? Right.
I knew that, but I couldn't see how it was like a physical disease. When I started thinking about addiction under the broad category of mental or behavioral health, it started making a lot more sense to me. As opposed to comparing it to liver disease or diabetes or, you know, those types of things.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, that's pretty much the definition of a disease or an illness that a lot of people, I think, probably use, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And I wanted to read one more definition. This one's from the Merriam-Webster mm-hmm. website. It states here, a condition of the living animal or plant body or one of its parts that impairs normal functioning and is typically manifested by distinguishing signs and symptoms. And it goes on, it has some synonyms, mm-hmm. sickness mm-hmm. and malady.
Yeah.
And when I think about that, and I think about how they kind of outline addiction being a disease, reason being that it's progressive. It you know, if you've done drugs and alcohol long enough, it has literally rewired your brain, especially the limbic system, the oldest part of our brain.
Right.
And that's why, you know, like a lot of people in science will call it the lizard brain, because that's where our core functions are. In the limbic system, that's where our temperature is gauged. That's where some of our memories are stored. And it gets affected, because now all of a sudden we take this stuff and our dopamine levels rise. And out of our brain reward system, we like that. And if you're anything like me, partying, it's like I just had to have enough. It was always into oblivion. I always wanted to get to that oblivious state. And it got to the point where I had to. Mm-hmm. And that really breaks it down to where people say, is it a choice? I think it's a choice to use. And I would love to hear your feedback on this. I think it's a choice to use to get drunk, mm-hmm. to snort a rail of cocaine, to do a hot shot of heroin, or today it's fentanyl. You know, I think that's a choice. But somewhere along the line, from us doing it for so long, if you're anything like me, I can only really kind of speak from my experience. that it's the choice is kind of gone. You get to the point where you're like, okay, I don't want to be this way anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to make the right choice to get away from it, but it's like it almost lures you back every time.
Right.
So yeah, if you wanted to kind of,
it, you know, it. I always hearken back to, you know, the early days of my using. Okay, there, I had a pretty, you know, broad set of friends. Mm-hmm. You know, let's say high school. On any given day, and particularly weekends, there would be a group of 10, 15, 20 or more people smoking weed, drinking beer, getting drunk, you know. And as time went on, I grew up in the hippie era, you know, maybe some of us would be dropping acid, taking mushrooms or something like that, you know.
Right.
A little older, doing cocaine, you'd see, you know, the whole group of people, you know, doing this stuff. But why then did only about maybe six, seven of us end up continuing to get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and ending up with severe addiction, severe alcoholism, dying, going to prisons, and or getting into recovery? You know, what was different about us? You know, and if you look into some of our histories, you'd see that a lot of people just aged out of it.
Mm-hmm.
They stopped doing it. The rest of us, we started experiencing more and more problems in our life that were directly connected to our using, and yet we kept using more and more and more and more. It was completely irrational. If you don't understand addiction, you know, it was completely irrational. A lot of us had alcoholism and addiction in our families. A lot of us had some predisposing, you know, psychological or psychiatric type of issues, a lot of high risk factors and that sort of thing. And that I know now, looking back,
mm-hmm.
There was something wrong with us even back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right from the get-go, it started to, I think, affect some of our brains differently than it did some of our buddies, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of, I've heard it, hearing people say this, it's been very relatable to me. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like when they drank their first beer or hit their first joint, they're like, it's kind of like the lights came on.
Yeah.
It's like something changed. Like there was this epiphany or this synthetic spiritual awakening that kind of happened, that things were clearer and functioning seemed easier.
Yeah.
Where fitting in seemed like it was able to be done with a little bit of ease, and going to work and getting our jobs done, we're able to focus a little bit better. And and always, like, as my disease, as my addiction worsened, you know, it was kind of like, okay, I got to the point finally, I'm like, yeah, I'm not functioning well at all. You know, and I always think about to people like, oh man, I'm not going to give you my keys because we're drinking, because I drive better drunk. And I'm like, talk about an altered state of reality.
Yeah, right.
You know, yeah. And how we just fool ourselves. And for me, you made an interesting point earlier where you're like, when it was explained to me as in like a disease, mm-hmm. As a disease, that's when I kind of said, well, maybe I can do something about this. I really thought I was just a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And I was weak. I really thought I was a piece of shit and I was weak. And when they explained it that way, and because like me, when I study for school or do something for work, I don't sequence very well. Like I'm all over the place, you know, I'm very busy in my brain. But if I have something to help me kind of narrow that down, and something that's very close to linear, it doesn't have to be in a linear order, but if it's from like point A to point Z, but sometimes we'll go to A to D to A, and you kind of get, because, you know, we do have to respect the recovery communities out there and the means and pathways to get to find recovery. So I do a 12-step based mm-hmm. program. And when I did that, finding out that it was more of a disease and it wasn't a moral failing and it wasn't the lack of willpower, because I tried like hell, I wanted to. Mm-hmm. I ended up getting in trouble with the law. But once that happened, I said, oh my God, I can do something about this. And then coupling that with spirituality and me, you know, kind of turning my life over to God that I understand, and then taking the steps, finding someone to work me through those, and really helped me out, because I really kind of, I did. I was able to put aside that what we were talking about earlier, that I always had to be the smartest guy in the room. I didn't have to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. I really said, okay, teach me. Oops. Teach me.
Right.
Someone teach me. And it goes back to that saying, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Right. It's kind of a little cliche or whatever, but, you know, I've heard some people say it's dis-ease, you know? And I had a lot of dis-ease in my life,
yeah,
even before I started using. You know, I was I was diagnosed as hyper. Okay, they didn't have ADD or ADHD back then. You were hyper.
Yeah.
Okay, and anxious.
Yeah.
And a little bit shy. And like for me, when I discovered alcohol and drugs, it was like you said, it was like, whoa, this is like the missing vitamin that I needed all this time. This is helping me to
like your vitamin D.
Yeah, to not feel so much dis-ease.
Yeah.
And it's if you think about it in one way, logically, if a young adolescent is feeling all this dis-ease and is, you know, maybe too shy to talk to girls or doesn't feel as good as or whatever as other people, and you discover something that will help you to feel better and be able to do things, it is going to be like the most powerful motivation that, yeah, that you could possibly have, you know, for an adolescent male to be able to go up and talk to girls or to dance or to go to a party or to sit in a classroom and not feel so jumpy or whatever, you know. It's like, of course you're going to do it over and over again.
Right.
You know? And frankly, at first it really does seem to work. You know, it makes you feel better. But then it turns on you.
Yeah. And I don't know if you do this, but I always kind of looked back and like, when did it happen? When did I, you know, when did the fun stop and the addiction actually take over to where I was losing control? I was losing choice. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I didn't, you know, I wasn't in fifth grade when Miss Roberts asked me what we wanted to be when we got older. I didn't say, hey, I want to be in jail and a drug-riddled addict, not be able to pay his bills or go to work. And, you know, I didn't think that at all. I mean, in fact, in fifth grade, I told her I wanted to be someone that would make a difference. I said I didn't want to be an attorney or a firefighter or anything. I just wanted to make a difference. Mm-hmm. What that was, I don't know. And maybe that's what, you know, some of the community work I do today. Maybe that's what it is today. I'm not sure. I like my life today.
Yeah.
And
I have never met anybody that wants this.
Right.
Okay. And it's really one of the things that reinforces my belief that this is an illness, a disorder, a disease,
right,
you know, however you want to characterize that. It's nobody wanted to be like this. I didn't want to be that. I, you know, for God's sakes, I had no plans on my life. You know, and like you, I'm very lucky. You know, my life has turned out to be full of all kinds of blessings. It's, you know, just wonderful things. I've gotten so much more than I ever deserved. It's not even funny. But those years that, you know, of being out there, you know, I never in a million years would have thought that would happen to me. Yeah. Ever. And, you know, why did it happen to me? Obviously, I'm not a weak person. I'm not a immoral person. If I was, then how come, like, all of a sudden I went into treatment and since then I've been clean and spent 40 years trying to help people?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, it's like if I was at my core this weak, bad piece of crap person,
yeah,
you would think that would have lingered on, right, whether I used drugs or I didn't use drugs, but it didn't. And frankly, the hundreds and thousands of people I've known in recovery over the years, it's the same with them, you know.
Yeah.
I can understand why other people look at us, though, and think that it's willful, that we're doing this, we're choosing to do this, because that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And because they don't have it, and they can drink, or they can smoke some weed, and it doesn't cause them any problems.
Right.
And so it's very difficult for them to look at us and understand, you know, why don't you just do what I do. Don't drink that much or don't use those drugs, you know.
Yeah. It's like your world burning around you. What are you doing?
Yeah, don't you see this, you know?
And inside I'm like, I know it. I don't want to do it anymore.
Right.
And yeah, and it's funny because, you know, before, you know, Nick and I here at the radio station, I was kind of tossing around, what would the first episode be? Mm-hmm. And I really felt this would be a great catapult, a good launching pad to kind of talk about. Because I really think it really cracks open the conversation of going into addiction, into recovery, into wellness, and how do you find this, and how do you use your past to benefit your future and help others? You know, if you're a wounded warrior or a wounded healer, and you want to use that to help others, because I've met some people that have some incredible stories that have some really nasty trauma in their lives.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, thank you for not giving up. Just to hear them say that, and it may not just affect me, but to who may be feeling the same thing that they felt.
Right.
And how our past becomes our, at least for me, my greatest asset. Mm-hmm. I'm able to look back and say, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be this selfish. I what kind of dude do I want to be today? Mm-hmm. What kind of father do I want to be today? What kind of employee do I want to be today? Mm-hmm. I think about that stuff today. Before, I didn't care. I thought all my employers owed me monies, all the girls ripped me off, my parents are the ones that do me, and the government is the one that enslaved me. You know, and oh my gosh, how much, like a whole 180,
right.
How it turned around. So if you don't mind, you know, I polled Facebook. I did a post, and I said, hey, disease, not a disease or a choice. Tell me what you guys think. And I said, please play nice.
Yeah.
So I said, please play nice. And they did. They shared their opinion, and they spoke with civility, and they were respectful, and it was really cool. This one, I can't remember all of them. I'm just going to read it as it is.
Okay.
This one, I'm not going to mention their name, but this individual said, hard to say, honestly, because I think there's a hereditary disposition to drugs. Some people try and drop stuff in high school, and some get stuck and can't shake it. Some people get hurt or anxious and get prescribed Xanax or pain pills, and it destroys their life. Regardless of what people think it is, they should worry less about worrying rather or not if it is a disease and focus on getting addicts better and becoming a functional part of society. I thought that was a really great explanation.
Yeah.
from this individual. Kind of like what you were talking about earlier. Kind of coincides with that a little bit.
Well, it's, you know, I think we all come to recovery in our own ways, and we all actually come to this disease in our own ways too. And there are people. And this is where, you know, science knows a lot about this, but they don't know everything. And,
yeah.
You know, there are people that I think become addicted to drugs,
mm-hmm.
just by using them, okay? You know, almost by accident,
yeah.
If you know what I mean. And it seems like right now there's a lot of focus on that group of people. I don't think it's that huge of a group of people. But there is, you know, guy has a sport injury, guy that is a vet, a guy mm-hmm. that, you know, that has some kind of pain that gets prescribed this stuff. They take it for a period of time, and it gets its, you know, claws into his brain or her brain, and they can't shake it, you know.
Yeah.
As opposed to somebody like me that, like, right from the beginning, like, something clicked. I mean,
mm-hmm.
some of these people are people that never had any kind of problem with chemicals
mm-hmm.
and ended up addicted.
Right.
So it may be a little more, I mean, there's a gray area there of people that may not have that biological predisposition, whether it's genetic or something else, and right from the beginning they took off and, you know, with alcoholism and addiction, but they end up in the same type of situation, but got there in a different way.
Yeah, I agree totally. And it's really funny, the next, response after mm-hmm. the one that we just read,
mm-hmm.
The individual says, take drug out of the phrase, so take drug out of addiction, drug addiction,
yeah.
remove drug,
right.
And they say, and ask, what is addiction on its own? And it's like, it's funny with me, it's like, I would even get in my worst, like sugar. Mm-hmm. I would get like so involved with sugar. That's all I wanted, and that's all. Soda, gummy bears, mm-hmm. All those things. You know, gummy bears, and really, and it always seems like even when you take the like me, I got really bad, and I'm not unique in that in any sense. I've met so many people that has kind of been down that scale of where I was at. And I probably could have even went further down the scale, you know. And when I think about that, and I think about addiction and removing drug out of it, mm-hmm. We all have some vice, something. Some of us will work out too much. Some of us will eat too much. Some of us will shop too much. And again, we all have that vice. And for me, my vice, this addiction became this overwhelming thing that was spread like a cancer and it started destroying the people around me. It wasn't just destroying me, it was destroying my mom, my dad. My family would talk about me when I wasn't around and they would get in arguments about it. So it literally is like a domino effect into what I kind of feel is the pits of hell. It's just like going towards it because that's where it feels. Mm-hmm. It's just like this internal damnation of fire within the family. But fortunately, I'm here today and I could speak on the behalf of myself being in recovery. And for people to share their comments on this, I think it's important for us because it is. I believe it's not only an individual disease or a family disease. I think it's a community disease. Mm-hmm. And we think about how people can attack each other over this. And people are like, oh, they're wasting all the money. They're wasting all the resources. And just how it really affects our community as a whole, and breaking it down to the molecular level where it comes back to me.
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, I mean, they have their, you know, their faults and that sort of thing, but there's also a lot of wisdom that came out of those organizations. And, you know, one of the steps talks about being restored to sanity. And that helped me, believe it or not, understand or kind of believe the addiction part of this also, because it's not really all the crazy stuff we do when we're high that mm-hmm. is the insanity of addiction. It's the fact that we have the ability, and me included, you know, just because I have 40 years of sobriety doesn't mean I'm immune to this. We have the insane ability to experience just the most unbelievable pain and suffering for ourselves and those around us, and be maybe even clean for a while, and somehow come up with the thought that using again is a good idea.
Right.
Okay. That is insane. I mean, it's crazy. In the face of overwhelming evidence that you are going to go right back down into that, as you called it, pit of hell,
mm-hmm.
you can choose that. You can actually talk yourself into thinking that's okay. And that's crazy. You know, I mean, not to use a layman's term, that's crazy. And for me, it's like I have a mental illness that's kept at bay by working my recovery program. But I have the ability, if I'm not still vigilant, I may be a little safer than somebody that's only 40 days sober, but still, if I'm not vigilant, I have the ability to somehow, you know, I'm retired now. I could sit back and say, like, you know, my kids are grown. I don't have a job anymore.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice to sit out on my front porch and, you know, fire up a joint and, you know, just kind of uncork a bottle of wine on a vacation? It'll be all right. I've been clean. You know, that is possible as
right.
an addict. That thought, if I don't stay on top of my game, could happen.
Yeah.
And I've got a very good friend that just started, he relapsed after 37 years, you know? And it's just mind-boggling. I mean, he had a great life, everything going well and stuff like that. And he stopped going to meetings, he stopped doing all that stuff. And there was a bottle of vodka, and he just said, you know what? This is a good idea. And he just started chugging it. Within 2 months, he was in the hospital, you know. He's sober again, thank God. But it's like, that's crazy shit right there.
Yeah.
This crazy time. So that, to me, there's that mental illness component of this, of addiction.
Yeah. And you saying that, it reminds me of like hearing people always say, I can't do drugs anymore. I can't drink. I'm like, no. You can.
Yeah, you can.
I think if you like, if you don't want to,
yeah.
and you realize why you don't want to, and I think that's why it's important to continue the daily reprieve, doing things daily, being of service, volunteering, and not shutting off the sanity part of our brain mm-hmm. to where we're just like, oh, I got it under control.
Yeah,
I ain't got nothing under control. I have a little bit of faith mm-hmm. in a God that I understand, and I have a little bit of action that I take today.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I don't control much,
mm-hmm.
And I don't know that much. And I love learning today and all that stuff. And you sharing the stuff, I appreciate that with all the honesty. And, you know, we're going to be wrapping up here in about 10, 15 minutes. So before we get to the Dr. Volkow mm-hmm. snippet, the soundbite, and before we get to Dr. Mark Lewis's Biology of Desire book, mm-hmm. Let's take one more quick break and let's hear from Gateway Foundation, again, one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
It's time to get serious about your drug or alcohol problem. It's going to cost you your job, your marriage, your family, and possibly your life. The Gateway Foundation has helped over 1 million people just like you free themselves from addiction. But we can't help you if you don't call us. One of our counselors is ready to have a confidential conversation with you right now at 1-877-629-4829. 1-877-629-4829. Call 1-877-629-4829. Visit GatewayFoundation.org before it's too late.
All right, welcome back. Thank you again to Gateway Foundation for supporting us here. Mike, if you don't mind, I wanted to play the audio clip mm-hmm. from Dr. Volkow. I think this was from about 2 years ago. I could be wrong. She was giving a lecture, and she's talking a little bit about her personal story before that her grandfather passed away from alcoholism, and she didn't find out until she got way older. And She's from Mexico City, so she's kind of got a little bit of an accent, but she's very, very knowledgeable. This is what she's been doing, mm-hmm. Studying the brain, really in regards to addiction. Right. So let's go ahead and listen to that.
So I wonder how I had miscommunicated. How could I have not make her realize that it was okay to speak about addiction? And then as I think, of course, I've gone over this many times in my brain, and I realize that describing addiction as a brain disease, describing addiction as a chronic brain disease, is sort of a theoretical concept. Say that you have two parents with a very sick child, and they go to the hospital. And the doctor says, your child is in a coma because he has diabetes. And he explains to them that diabetes is a disease of the pancreas. It's a chronic disease of the pancreas. But this does not explain why that child is so severely ill. What explains it is the understanding that the cells in the pancreas can no longer produce insulin. And we need insulin in order to be able to use glucose as an energy source. So without it, the cells in our body are energy deprived, which explains why this child is so sick. So when we speak about addiction as a chronic disease of the brain, what does it mean? How does it help us explain the devastating changes in behavior of a person that's addicted, where even the most severe threat of punishment is insufficient to have them stop taking drugs, where they are willing to give everything they care for in order to take a drug? How does that dysfunction in the brain help us understand that? Well, to start with, we've known for many years that all of the drugs of abuse that produce addiction, all of them, whether it's legal or illegal, All of them increase dopamine in brain reward regions, activating them. And that, in turn, motivates our actions, which explains why behaviors that are rewarding have been used by nature in order to ensure that we survive as an individual and as a species. And that's why food is so rewarding. That's why sex is rewarding, so we can survive and procreate. And drugs hijack that system.
So yeah, I think she, in that part, it's a 22 minute video you can find on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And for those listening, we'll have a link that you can look at as well if you wanted to check out the rest of it. She's very knowledgeable, and she's able to paint a really good picture about the brain, addiction, disease. Is there anything in there, Mike, that kind of was able to ring a bell of any sorts, or even was relatable? I know for me, when she was kind of talking about the brain reward, and she says it hijacks the brain, I'm like, it made me think of when my instincts, you know, my instincts as a human being, like she was kind of talking about sex and food, it did get hijacked. It's like they went haywire when I was in active addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was nothing more important. I mean, I even though it's been a long time, I still can recall waking up in the morning and almost with a panic feeling. Okay, mm-hmm. Because I always told myself I would save some drugs for the next day, and I almost never did. And so my first thought was, how am I going to get money and how am I going to get drugs?
Yeah.
And my job, my family, anything else was secondary to that. And I was going to keep, you know, following that path to that drug no matter what. It definitely hijacked my brain.
Yeah. And I agree with you 100%. It was like that was it. That it was a full-time job to do what I was doing.
Right.
I didn't really care about sex. I didn't really care about women. I didn't care about really seeing my kids. But after I got my fix, I did. I was like, oh, I want to do all this. But I've done burnt the house down, and I'm asking everybody to come sit at the kitchen table again. That's not there.
Right.
And and she's got such a compelling line of evidence and stuff, and so if anybody wants to check her out, and you want to build your own argument, because we're getting towards the end here, and we're going to come to a conclusion. And again, I think we know what the conclusion is going to be with actually answering that question. But Mike, if you don't mind, I would love to read a little part out of an excerpt from Mark Lewis's The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease, if you're okay with that. For those of you listening, Mark Lewis is also in recovery. From his story, he was in active addiction, I believe, from heroin way back when, in like the 60s and 70s. He's now a neuroscientist, and he does not believe that addiction is a disease. He believes that it is a problem. You know, you may even say it's a malady. Maybe even a disability, but if you want to check out more, the book ain't that long, and he really does a really great job to plead his case. So if you want to get a little bit more knowledgeable in addiction and information that is related to that, this is a great book to start with. So I'm going to be reading out of page 23 from the section where he says, "A Fresh Look at the Brain." Yet, among the opponents of the disease model, no one has fought fire with fire and tackled its neuroscientific foundations. Like the general public, most of those arguing against the disease model assume that brain change automatically implies a disease process. Then they change the subject. Others tune out or get mad when the brain is even mentioned in regard to addiction, because they assume that a neuroscientific description will somehow replace a more psychological or humanistic perspective rather than complement it. It's as if students of addiction have to choose: either admit the brain is really is a really important organ, in which case addiction is a brain disease, or put the brain back in the closet, in which case you can go on talking about choice, environmental factors, social anthropology, and all the rest of it. In his most recent book, Stanton Peale, a longtime opponent of the disease model, gives his readers a stark choice. Either accept addiction as a brain disease, in which case addicts are powerless to fight it, or recognize that addiction is a personal self-defeating habit. Peale wants to reject the fatalism inherent both in the disease model and in some other rhetoric. With this, I concur, but we don't have to reject neuroscience or the other to do that. In fact, a fresh look at the brain can help.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Stanton Peale said that the neuroscientific approach is a fatalistic type of approach, and that meaning that the addict has no way out of this. And the truth is, the addict does have a way out. You and I are both proof of that.
Yeah.
You know, there is hope and help. You know, I'm not saying it's easy, but it certainly exists. I kind of agree with the first guy. I do see the neuroscientific aspect of it complementing the psychological and environmental factors. Mm. I mean, this has for many years been calling it like a biopsychosocial illness, you know, right. That there are different components of it, and they exist in different, they manifest themselves differently in different people's lives. But what I want to ask either of those gentlemen, okay, so I've been clean for 40 years, all right? I've addressed a lot of my issues that I had probably before I even started using. Mm-hmm. I'm relatively comfortable, responsible, mature, fully functioning adult human being, all right? So if I start using again tonight, all right, mm-hmm. does that mean I'm going to be able to just be like a social drinker?
If you're asking me, I couldn't do it.
I'm asking them.
Yeah.
It's like, so what, why not? I mean, it's like if this isn't something wrong with my brain that is chronic condition that I have that I'm going to have till I die, then why can't I just go down to Morrison's Tavern down on the corner there and say, hey, my name's Morrison. How about a beer? And just have one or two beers and go home. It's like. And I know that isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Okay.
I still to this day don't understand one or two. It's like, what is that?
Well, I know plenty of people that are social drinkers, you know, or that I know people that smoke weed sometimes and it doesn't seem to cause them any problems.
Yeah.
That ain't me, though.
Yeah.
And I'm not willing to take that chance. I have seen way too many people over the years that did take that chance. And it invariably ends up with them either dead, you know, horrible things happening to them, or they come back and get back in recovery again. Yeah. And it happens every time.
Yeah.
So I have to believe that there's something going on in my brain and probably the brain of a lot of other people that have this same thing.
I agree.
I call it an illness, a disease, a disorder, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's in me.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like to say I'm pretty messed up.
I just don't want to take a chance and experiment with my own life.
Yeah. You know? I've heard a few people actually say it's, you know, a thinking disease, mm-hmm. and that makes so much sense to me as well.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, because my thinking can get pretty congested. Mm-hmm. It can be very congested, and thank God for people that can. Take time to let me vomit my rants.
Right.
Like if I got something going, you know, because again, I don't know everything, and to be able to take that congestion and get it out, and then I can look at it and go, oh my God, I was making a big deal on nothing, I think, you know, disease or not a disease, I don't even really think that really matters at this point. I think it has affected our communities. Mm-hmm. I think addiction has been around for centuries upon centuries since they've been able to figure out how to scrape poppy to crushing grapes for wine. Mm-hmm. And we've always had a sense of escapism. And then some of us, unfortunately, unlike the others, we got hooked. Like you said, you got the claws that got put in you, and some of us took it too far, and then some of us got to the point of no return and we didn't get to make it back. So I'm very fortunate that I'm able to sit here across the table and speak to you. Mm-hmm. Like I said, when we first began, I learned a lot about you. I felt like I already knew you from your wife. She's had nothing but great things to say about you. I don't know what it's like when you guys are at home, but...
Oh, it's just like that, Tom. Yeah. She worships the ground I walk on.
Yeah. She rolls out the red carpet when you come in from the art studio. Mm-hmm. So, in closing, is there any final remarks that you want to kind of speak on?
Yeah, I do. And I'm going to disagree with you on one thing. I think it does matter whether it's a disease or it's not a disease. Because if there's any people out there that are still in active addiction listening to this, and if they're at all like you and me, they think they're worthless, weak pieces of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I want them to know that that's not true. There's something wrong with them. Whether you want to call it a disease or a malady or an illness or whatever, I'm sure there are some physicians or researchers and doctors that sort of thing that would say, it's a disease, just call it a disease. Right. Since 1956, the American Medical Association has designated alcoholism as a disease, and since 1987, addiction's been called a disease. Why can't you people just believe that? Okay. I want them to know that there's something wrong with you. You're not a bad, weak person. You may have done bad things, okay, but you're not a bad person, and everything can change for you if you want it to. So,
I think that's an awesome closing statement. My grandmother said, growing up, there's no tie. She raised me for about 6 years. There's no such thing as a bad person. Sometimes a sick or lost person. Mm-hmm. So I think with that, I cannot thank you enough for joining us. I had a really great time. I don't know about you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great.
Yeah, and we'll have to do this again. Maybe we can do like a follow-up.
Sure.
Again, thank you. Thank you to our sponsor, Gateway Foundation. And thank you to the WBGZ for allowing us the opportunity to use the studio. And I think with that, we can close out.
All right.
Bye, everybody.
I get